Okay, so I really enjoyed this morning, and I hope you do as well. And it's going to continue now because we are having the pleasure to host Bart Lambrecht. He's a professor of pulmonary medicine at the University of Ghent in Belgium, and he's head of the Inflammation Research Center in the same university. Bert is also a rare person because he's really changed our view of pulmonary allergy, especially asthma, in the sense that asthma was considered so far a sort of disease of bronchoconstriction and all these things that were a bit mysterious, and he basically changed the view and put it in the field of inflammation. And is really making of asthma now a disease that is immunologically mediated. He has identified the dendritic cells and the subpopulations which are involved. But more than that, he's really putting it in the context of this hygiene hypothesis that we all hear about. And this is a very nice example of this postmodern disease where changing exposure to the microbial environment actually causing dysfunction of the immune system, and asthma will be part of this. So I'm absolutely delighted to hear this story from Bart Lambrecht, and I'm sure you will as well. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Philippe, for the kind invitation. Also, thanks to Hooks for inviting me and organizing this meeting. So just to put you in scope with the problem, just like Philippe was saying, asthma is one of those diseases of modern society. So. This slide was taken from a colleague of yours, from Jean-François Bach here in Paris, showing how the incidence of immune-mediated diseases has increased since the Second World War. So since 1950, we see an almost fourfold, and sometimes in some countries even an eightfold increase in the occurrence of asthma in a very short time frame. But the same thing is also happening for other immune-mediated diseases like type 1 diabetes, multiple sclerosis, autoimmunity of the brain, and Crohn's disease, which is an inflammatory disease of the intestine. And this is rather frustrating because this has occurred at the same time that we have learned very much about the immune system. So it seems like the more we know about the immune system, the more we are affected by immune-mediated diseases. Huh? At the same time, with vaccination, and all our knowledge about microbial pathogenesis, we have designed vaccines. And at the same time, all the infectious diseases have that used to threaten the Western world, all of those diseases are rapidly declining, not just due to vaccination, but also due to increased sanitation. Think about tuberculosis, for example. It was declining already from the beginning of the 1900s, in fact, due to treatment of cows' tuberculosis, but also due to sanitation. And this problem have, of course, been linked to each other. And maybe this is related to this. I'll come back to that later. But the scope of the problem is big, and I mean, studying the origin of life is not a trivial question. It's a very important question. But also understanding why allergy is so common is also not a trivial question, because nowadays, 1 in 3 children are allergic, which means that in any regular classroom of children, primary school, there would be 7 or 8 children who have an allergic disease. That's pretty amazing, that everybody knows about it now. Everybody has a child or a grandchild who has to take puffers or medications for allergy. And this didn't used to be the case. After the Second World War, 1950s, it was very uncommon to have allergies and asthma. This has totally changed. 1 in 8 children have clinical asthma requiring medication and often ending up in hospital. And then worldwide, there's about 700 million people who currently need allergy medications and that don't get access to it. There's only the minority in the world would have access to drugs for allergy. And the size of the problem also economically is huge. So in the US, it's been estimated that a disease like asthma, so it's only one of the allergy diseases, it costs $20 billion per year to the society. $20 billion per year just to treat asthma. So it's really, really big medical problem. So the way that we study this disease is mainly we have been studying how we become allergic to house dust mite allergens. And house dust mites are in French, that's acariens, les acariens. They live in mattress, in sheets, you know, in blankets, and they feed themselves on human skin. So they're constantly living in environments where there are people. So if you would vacuum here and then put your the dust under the microscope, you would find house dust mites, without any doubt. Also in the seats here that you're sitting in, they're there. Everywhere there's humans, there's house dust mites. And they really look quite hostile, but in fact they're not. And we're not allergic to the house dust mite itself, but we're allergic to the fecal droppings of the house dust mite, because those are little membrane-encased droppings that are in the correct size. You see an electron microscope picture here. They're in the correct size. They're like a 1 to 2 micrometers big, and those can be inhaled in the deeper airways. These critters are too big to be inhaled, so we never ever get exposed to the actual organism. It's to the fecal droppings. And we know now there's at least 25 different allergens, and we've just done a sequencing of this organism, and we've actually discovered 30 new ones. So there's at least 60 allergens to which people react from within those fecal pellets. So products that are in there, people react to. And many of those allergens are cysteine proteinases, so they're proteolytically active. But because this is the poop of an organism, there's always microbes in there. There's always gram-positives, gram-negative, and fungi in those fecal pellets. And very likely, those things that we inhale together with the allergens are also the reason why we are allergic to this stuff, because this is providing the trigger for recognizing intrinsically harmless proteins from those bugs. And for example, the way that the house dust mite feeds on human skin, it uses a symbiont, a fungus, that provides the enzyme that can cleave human keratin. And this is how they can feed on human skin. So inevitably, you will also inhale fungal material in those fecal pellets. And for a long time, people used to think that the major portal of entry is the airways, because a lot of allergy is in fact asthma, and this is respirable material. So people thought, you know, that's going to be the natural route of sensitization to become allergic. However, there were a few studies in the beginning of the of 2000 that actually showed that the genetics for becoming allergic have nothing to do with airways, because a lot of the proteins that were identified with SNP, with genetic polymorphism studies to be associated with allergy development, many of those proteins were not expressed in the lungs at the first place, but they were expressed in the skin. And it appears now that one of the major risk factors for becoming allergic to house dust mite is defective skin barrier function. And for a long time, clinicians used to think that the first sign of allergy is a kid that is born with eczema. So if you have children in the first 2 months of life who have red arm folds, you know, in the elbows and the knees, if they were red, they said, oh, your child is already allergic. It's a sign of allergy. In fact, we know now it's a risk factor for allergy, because it's nothing else but permeable skin allowing allergens to penetrate through the skin and to induce sensitization to allergens. So how does asthma look like under a microscope? So this is a biopsy from a healthy individual or from an asthmatic individual. And you will see that the airways are inflamed. I think there's beyond doubt. You see that the red blood cells here accumulate in vessels. There's eosinophils here. See, there's eosinophils sitting here. And then there's structural remodeling of the airways. And you see this very nicely here. The basement membrane here, where the epithelium is sitting on, is much thicker than it is in the healthy condition. So here you hardly see the basement membrane. Here you see this, it's been estimated to be 7 to 10 micrometers thick basement membrane. And then you also see that in the airways, in the mucosa, there is overproduction of mucus. So asthma, and Philippe was giving me too many credits. I mean, I didn't invent the fact that asthma was an inflammatory disease. Now, this is a concept that has been starting to come up, you know, 30 years ago, that asthma is an inflammatory disorder. But people have never understood how inflammation would be controlled and how it would be induced in response to harmless antigens, because this is how you have to see it. You know, we're inhaling grass pollen or tree pollen or poop of house dust mites. This is not invasive to us. This is intrinsically harmless, yet still we mount an immune response to those triggers. And that's been a big question in the field. How can that happen? So what is the immunology behind this asthma inflammation or any form of allergy, if you will? There's been a central role attributed to a particular subtype of lymphocytes called Th2 lymphocytes. They are CD4 cells that produce IL-5, interleukin-5, and interleukin-5 is the prime cytokine driving the development of eosinophils from the bone marrow, and then those eosinophils get activated in the tissues, and then the eosinophils will degranulate and release all kinds of toxic components. The reason why we have eosinophils is to fight off helminth infection, and in fact, this is a response that looks like an anti-helminth response. So asthma is eosinophilic. It releases the large extracellular toxins that can kill large extracellular parasites. It's very damaging to membranes, and it basically denudes your basement membrane of epithelial cells. All of this stuff is very, very toxic, causing epithelial damage typical of asthma. And then the Th2 lymphocytes also make IL-4 and IL-13, and this will drive goblet cell metaplasia, so overproduction of mucus. And in fact, the overproduction of mucus, this is why people still die of asthma. The eosinophilia, we can beautifully treat that. There's now drugs coming on the market as we speak. In September 2016, there's a new biological on the market called mepolizumab. It's an anti-IL-5 blocking antibody that is given to patients with severe asthma. It's very costly, but it's really, really making a difference for severe asthmatics. For goblet cell metaplasia, we don't have anything for the moment. So when people die nowadays of asthma, they die with mucus in their airways. And I've seen patients with asthma in the intensive care where you do a bronchoscopy and you suck away the mucus and you in fact get a cast of the entire bronchial tree coming out of the airways, because the mucus is so tough and rigid, it can totally block the inside of the airways. It's very, 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 very dangerous to have this in your airways. And then finally, the remodeling that we see in the airways, so the thickening of the basement membrane and the fibrosis, is again induced by Th2 lymphocytes making growth factors like amphiregulin. This is an EGF-like molecule that drives fibrosis and also drives bronchial hyperactivity. And this bronchial hyperactivity, I need to explain to you, this is in fact what an asthma patient feels. So there's many patients with asthma who say, I am allergic to cold air, for example. I cannot inhale cold air. There is no such thing as allergy to cold air. No, you cannot be allergic to something, you know, physical. But what happens is that cold air is an enormous trigger for smooth muscle to contract. And that's called bronchial hyperactivity. Another example of that is exercise. When an asthmatic has an exercise, they have bronchoconstriction. And this is because the smooth muscle cells become hyperactive or hyperreactive, caused again by Th2 cytokines like IL-13 and IL-5. So no doubt about it that many of these cytokines now are now prime targets for biologicals. So IL-5 is on the market. There's now IL-4, IL-13 blockade being developed. There's molecules like VCAM1 blockade, VLA4 blockade. all of those are the new biologicals for asthma. And on top of that, the receptors expressed by these Th2 cells, some of them are also very druggable, right? Like the CCR4 receptor, for example. They're small molecule antagonists now, and these cytokines, I'll come back to them later, are also very druggable. IL-33 is a cytokine driving activation of Th2 cells, and it's very druggable. So this brings me back to the question, you know, how can we become allergic to those little fecal droplets if they're really not so dangerous and not so invasive? Same for tree pollen and grass pollen. And you have to think of it like this. So this is an electron microscope picture we took from a mouse lung. It's just out of the animal house, you know, you fix it and then you do an electron microscope picture. And you see how impermeable these airways in fact are. They're tightly connected epithelial cells, and then we inhale those fecal droplets. How can the immune system recognize across this impermeable barrier? And that's really the function of a network of antigen-presenting cells called dendritic cells that are sitting there and probing the airways. And this is a dual photon image we took. The blue here is the collagen under the basement membrane. Then the green is C11C. It's a marker for dendritic cells, antigen-presenting cells. And then we also injected an antibody to C11B in red, which shows you, in fact, that some of the green cells turn yellow, meaning that they are also expressing C11B, whereas other cells are just green and then others are red. So there's a big heterogeneity in a network of myeloid cells sitting around the airways in steady state conditions. So this is an unmanipulated mouse fresh out of the animal house. So how do those cells grab antigens? This is again a dual photon image. It's now a class 2 GFP knock-in. This is the airway lumen. There's a dendritic cell sitting here, and it's extending its dendrites here into the airway lumen. So this is how you can recognize inhaled antigens across this impermeable barrier. It's because those dendritic cells are specialized for probing the environment by sticking out dendrites. And in the airways, they do that with very long dendrites sitting in the mucus layer, whereas in the gut, they do it with a little periscope technique. So they stick out one single dendrite that's then probing around in the mucus of the gut, trying to find commensals, pathogens, and trying to make sense of what they are. In the skin, it's exactly the same. The Langerhans cells of the skin, you might have remembered those from your biology course, Langerhans cells of the skin are the dendritic cells of the skin, and they themselves form this probing behavior just underneath the keratin layer. So the keratin layer is impermeable, but if something goes through, the first cells that they recognize are differentiating keratinocytes, and in between those you find these long dendrites probing for antigen. Okay, so do we need those dendritic cells for allergy development? And this is an experiment or series of experiments we did over the years. This is a mouse where you can deplete dendritic cells using a diphtheria toxin strategy. So normal mice don't have the diphtheria toxin receptor, so they are insensitive to diphtheria toxin. You can reintroduce the receptor in a cell-specific manner and then kill only those cells that have the receptor. So if you do this with a C11C promoter, you only kill the C11C expressing cells, which are dendritic cells and macrophages, etc. So we did this when mice received a first injection of house dust mite intranasally, and then we depleted dendritic cells by giving an intraperitoneal injection of diphtheria toxin, followed by house dust mite challenges to the nose. And in this model, if you actively sensitize with house dust mite and challenge with house dust mite, you get this typical airway eosinophilia, here the black bars, that you don't see if you don't give house dust mite here, only give house dust mite there. So you induce eosinophilia, and you also induce these typical cytokines, interleukin 5 and interleukin 13. But if you deplete your dendritic cells during this sensitization, this response fails to develop. And this is showing effectively that dendritic cells are required for allergy to develop. But there's an intrinsic problem with this strategy, like we did it over the years, is that CD11C is expressed on many subsets of cells in the body. So this is really a bewildering complexity of the different cells, and this is too much, I think, for this audience. But suffice it to say that there are now four subtypes of dendritic cells that have been described. You can compare it a little bit with the T-cell biology field in the 60s. You know, the first thing they did is they discovered thymocytes. And then, you know, 5 years later, people said, you're crazy if you're dividing thymocytes. You know, but you can only understand how thymocyte development works if you can separate them into double negatives, double positives, single positives, etc. The same with T cells. Initially, we had CD4 T cells, and then the Th1, Th2 concept came, and then Th17 Tregs came, and now, you know, they have this plethora of cells which really exist. And when do you know that they exist? Is when you find transcription factors that are master regulators of development. And this is what's happening now to the dendritic cell field. So you have conventional dendritic cells split up in two populations. You have plasmacytoid DCs, and you have monocyte-derived DCs. And there's a bewildering complexity in the field. Everybody has his favorite marker combination, so this is really, really bad, because you cannot compare what people are saying in the gut with what people are saying in the skin and what people are saying in the lungs. Very complex, you know? And then even within the lung field, somebody would use, you know, Langerin to identify this subset, and then another group would use CD24. As a favorite thing. So suppose you would do that with T cells, you know, like it would not work, right? You know, everybody knows if you look at T cells, you start with CD3, CD4, CD8, and then within the CD4s, you go on with your subtype, within the CD8 the same. So based on this idea and to reduce complexity, we have recently collaborated with three big dendritic cell labs, and we've looked in all species, in all organs. So not all species, of course, but we've looked at humans, mice, rats, monkeys, sheep, bats even. So we've looked in a big variety of species to see whether we can find a unifying gating strategy that would work in every tissue. And I think we have come up to a consensus that you know, we presented already a few times to larger audiences. And I think this will be the new gating strategy where everybody should move into. So the first thing, again, you know, you can read the primary papers. They're just out this week in Immunity, actually. The first thing you do is you have to be sure that you're not looking at macrophages, because macrophages closely resemble dendritic cells. So you put a gate based on the Fc gamma receptor, CD64, and F480, and double positive cells are macrophages. You can subdivide those as well. I won't go into detail there. And then you use class 2 expression. Remember the long dendrites I showed you, they were class 2 positive, excluding T and B cells and granulocytes. And then within this gate, you use CD11C, but that's not enough. You also need to add a new marker called CD26, because CD11C doesn't work in every organ and it doesn't work in every species. So by adding CD26 and gating on double positive cells, you will actually get a beautiful DC gate. And then within this gate, we use XCR1 and SIRP alpha or CD172 to separate the two subsets. This works in every organ, every species. It's really, really very nice. And then to make our point that it's really a lineage, you can also look at the lineage defining transcription factors. And in fact, those guys are IRF4 high and those guys are IRF8. And the new terminology that's increasingly seen in the field is to call those CDC1 and those are CDC2. It's very easy to to remember. Just remember what CD8 cells are for MHC1 and what CD4 cells are for MHC2. This is how I remember it. No? A CDC1 will induce cross-presentation, CD8 responses, MHC1 responses, call it DC1. A DC2 is mainly CD4 responses, you know, it's a MHC class 2 presentation. And the good thing is that also here the IRF4 is like CD4, IRF8 is like CD8. No, this is how you can remember it. There's a mnemotechnic. If you teach immunology, you have to say MHC1 times CD8 equals MHC2 times CD4. This is how you can remember your restriction. You know, it's 2 times 4 is 1 times 8, right? The same for here. Remember it like this. This is going to be the new gating strategy. And the cool thing is, this is so robust and reproducible that you can use a machine learning algorithm to throw it on your sample, all your samples that you have across all organs, and without any manual gating, the machine learning algorithm will do the gating for you. And this is the example of this. So these are all the organs of a mouse that we looked at, but the same is done in humans in this paper here. You just ask the algorithm without manual gating, you know, organize the populations, a self-organizing map. And then you see that in all organ, it's projecting this population. And if you ask where are those populations, no, you can get a beautiful separation across all organs for your dendritic cells. So we're totally moving into this, into automated gating of samples, because flow cytometry gating is an erratic process. You know, it's really based on belief more than on hard data. But with the machine learning algorithm, it's the hard data that talk for themselves, you know, and then you analyze your samples based on a self-organizing map algorithm. And now that mass cytometry is available with 80 parameters on one cell, and the regular flow cytometers within 2 to 3 years will be 30 colors. We're going to 30 color flow cytometry within 2 years. You need these algorithms. You cannot do that manually anymore because the experiment takes one day of acquisition, and then the analysis takes 30 days of experimentation and analysis. So we need to move into automated things. So with this now at hand, you know, this good separation, you can also ask the question, oh, which of those DCs is now sufficient if you expose an animal to house dust mite, and then you sort the subsets from the mediastinal lymph nodes 3 days after exposure, which of those dendritic cells can actually transfer the disease to another animal? And there it's very clear that only the CDC2s can transfer the disease, and the monocyte-derived dendritic cells can transfer the disease. So this is shown here in terms of eosinophilia. And then the CDC1s, which are the cross-presenting DCs, they do not transfer allergic asthma. So to summarize this part of my talk, in fact, what is happening when you inhale antigens is that the antigen is taken up by the dendritic cells sitting in this network around the airways, and then the CDC2s migrate to the draining lymph nodes, where they will activate naive T cells, and we can study this very nicely. You know, this is a new TCR transgenic that we generated for house dust mite. You see these very nice divisions here in the mediastinal lymph nodes. And then the dividing T cells go back to the periphery. As divided cells, they end up in the periphery, and it's mainly the monocyte-derived DCs that will re-stimulate those effector T cells. I didn't show the primary data, but it's actually in those articles. So coming back to the question now, you know, if dendritic cells are really driving this response to allergens, how do those dendritic cells get activated in the first place? You know, and you have to think of it, when a child becomes allergic, it's becoming allergic at a phase, you know, where it's seeing many things at the same time. You know, it's also being exposed to a lot of viruses. Think about RS virus, you know, RSV, respiratory syncytial virus. It's mainly hitting the first 2 years of life, where it can cause a severe bronchiolitis. And a severe bronchiolitis is a very strong risk factor for becoming asthmatic later in life. And so there's this link between viruses and sensitization. And then we live in a polluted environment. You know, there's cigarette smoke, there's diesel particles, ozone concentrations are high. And all of those things that we know from epidemiology are also very well known to cause allergic sensitization. A cigarette smoke in a mother, for example, it's about the strongest risk factor you can have for a child to become allergic. There's a 6 times higher risk of becoming house dust mite allergic when the mother smokes during pregnancy and in the first year of life of the child. So all of this needs to be integrated, you know, by the dendritic cell, and then the dendritic cell needs to make up its mind, you know, and say, I will mount a Th2 response or a Th1 response or a Th17 or a regulatory response, or I would just not care about the whole thing. Those are the possibilities, right? So it's obvious to assume that many of those things, including allergens, because it's poop from an organism, would be contaminated with toll-like receptor ligands, just like we've heard from Cyril's talk. Now, all those receptors are very much expressed in the airways, not only by the dendritic cells, but also by the epithelial cells. So we did an experiment a couple of years ago where we've looked at the role of toll-like receptor 4 in driving allergy to house dust mites. So we made bone marrow chimeric mice where you can have a knockout of TLR4 on the immune system or on the lung structural cells. And what was very remarkable is that the allergy that develops in the wild types was completely abolished in the TLR4 knockouts. But what was a bigger surprise to us, that you need TLR4 on the structural cells, because there's no asthma development when the radio-resistant cells lack TLR4, but you don't need TLR4 on the immune cells. Allergy still develops. And this was a very important pointer to us that the lung structural cells, the radio-resistant lung structural cells, are in fact expressing TLR4, and that triggering of TLR4 by allergens drives allergy development. And we've done a lot of experiments. I won't go into the experimental details. It's mainly the work of my long-term colleague, Hamida Hamad, who's actually co-directing the unit with me. And what we have found is, in fact, that house dust mite exposure leads to triggering of TLR4 receptors, and this leads to the production of endogenous danger signals that will then lead to an autocrine loop of IL-1 production acting on the epithelium again to produce pro-Th2 cytokines like IL-33, TSLP, GM-CSF, and this programs the dendritic cells to induce allergy. So how could all of this be related to the gene by environment interaction? Now, if it's really dendritic cells talking with epithelial cells, and then the epithelial cells programming the dendritic cells to induce Th2 immunity, could this effect of the changing environment be caused by a disturbed epithelial dendritic cell communication? So we've started to address this a couple of years ago, and one of the strongest protective environments known to human medicine is in fact growing up in an endotoxin-rich environment. This is a beautiful study that Erika von Mussius did in Germany and Switzerland, where they have found that children, this is the amount of endotoxin in mattresses, not just in the bedroom, you measure the endotoxin content, and the higher the endotoxin content in your bedroom, the less likely you are to be IgE sensitized, to have hay fever and atopic wheezing. It's a very careful epidemiological study with more than 3,000 children that were probed over time in these environments. So endotoxin, high endotoxin, seems to protect from allergy. But this was epidemiology for a long time. So we've looked at this in the house dust mite model now, and we've exposed mice to low doses of endotoxin, 100 nanograms. This is not like really a very, very, you wouldn't get into sepsis or anything with these kinds of doses. It's a low dose of inhaled endotoxin prior to making mice allergic to house dust mite, followed by house dust mite challenges. So if you give no house dust mite here, just PBS sensitization, followed by house dust mite challenges, there's no eosinophilia, and there's no IgE, and there's no bronchial hyperactivity, this tendency of the airways to contract. If you actively sensitize and you pre-treat the animals with PBS, you develop this eosinophilia, house dust mite specific IgE responses, typical of allergy, and bronchial hyperactivity. But if you pre-treat the animals with low dose endotoxin, you can actually suppress the development of eosinophilia, IgE, and bronchial hyperactivity. And the reason why this endotoxin is doing this, it is in fact with this chronic tonic stimulation of 2 weeks, what you're doing is you're reducing the production of cytokines by lung epithelial cells. These are sorted lung epithelial cells from in vivo LPS exposed animals that were then treated with house dust mite. And you will actually see that in the PBS pretreated group, the house dust mite induces a chemokine that recruits dendritic cells, CCL20, and it produces the major growth factor for dendritic cells development and maturation called GM-CSF. But if the mice are pretreated with endotoxin, this response does not develop. So it seems like an environmental dirt, if you will, endotoxin, can protect your mouse from developing this, you know, cytokine mix that primes your dendritic cells. And where do you find these endotoxin-rich environments? This is in stables, you know, in farming environments, you know, and that's something you have to realize, you know, if you go for yourself, you know, and try to remember what did your great-parents, great-grandparents do, your grandparents, your own parents, and you yourself and your children, their profession. Think about it, you know, most of us came from farms, you know, in certainly in Belgium, you know, everybody was related to a farm. And there were really tiny little farms, you know, with a few cows. And often the stable was connected to the living house, you know, and there was high exposure to endotoxin. And this is still the case in Bavaria and in the regions of Switzerland close to Bavaria, where there's big cow stables with traditional farming, where the house is connected to the farm. And this is something that, again, Erica van Musius, our collaborator, found very nicely in epidemiology. And what is protecting on the farming environment? She has very carefully done that. And it's a really very nice slide because everything is on there. So it's drinking raw milk. It's close contact with livestock. So the cow has to be really close by. And sheep and cows are more protective than pigs, for example, because pigs have a super high endotoxin content in the stable environment. It's contact with moldy hay. No, and some of the symbionts you were mentioning, Cyril, actually, of the plant symbionts, make metabolites that have this suppressive effect, we found out now. And then the mother has to be in the stable during pregnancy, and it's mainly the first year of life. So this is a very, very nice slide because all the protection is on there. I'm not sure if she actually asked them to do this. But in real life, it's often the case. You know, when you're on the farm, work has to be done. And as soon as the child is born, the mother returns to the job, you know, and the child really goes into the environment where the cows and the work is being done. Huh? And we've collaborated with Erica, and she has sent us farm dust from collected from farms in Bavaria, just with an electrostatic device. You know, you can call it a Swiffer. It's really a Swiffer that's hang up in a kind of collection device, and electrostatically, you just collect the dust that's in the air of the farm, you make extracts, you put this in your mouse model, and you totally suppress airway eosinophilia, prevent airway eosinophilia. And then we've looked at the molecular mechanism of that, and we've been able to find that one of the deubiquitinating enzymes, which is also what you find in your small molecules to regulate your pattern recognition receptor regulation, or ubiquitination within the toll-like receptor family, is heavily controlled by deubiquitinases. One of them is called TNF-AIP3 or A20. If you take away A20 from your lung epithelium, you lose your protection. I won't explain exactly how it works, but suffice it to say, we also took this to a translational approach and again collaborated with Erica, where she was following children growing up on farms from birth onwards, and most of those children are protected when you're on a farm. But the children who still develop allergy when they're on a farm, when they grow up on a farm, they had a polymorphism of A20 that's inactivating the A20. And it's the same A20 polymorphism that's also associated with lupus and with Crohn's disease. So it's very likely that there's gene by environment interaction that we see in allergy development has something to do with the airway epithelium. And I think this is, if there's one thing I would like you to remember from my talk, is that the hygiene effect has been explained too much from the immunology perspective, because this is how you do it in epidemiological studies. You cannot go sample airways from patients when you do a big epidemiology study. The best you can do is take a blood sample, maybe one, maybe two or three shots, if you're allowed to do so ethically. So there's been a heavy bias on the hygiene hypothesis for direct effects on immune cells. What I would like to propose is that the hygiene effect can also affect our structural cells and the way that our structural cells react to the environment. Do I have still some time, Philippe, or I can stop here? I'll stop here. So I'll summarize that. I've summarized it, right? Okay. There's a problem with PowerPoint. So thanks a lot for your attention.